Welcome to episode 8 of the Crooked Row podcast. I am Kim, your host, coming to you from Nebraska in central United States of America. This week, I've got a few announcements to start off the podcast. And then I will move into a knitting update, as well as a gardening update. There's a lot that's happened since I talked to you last. And then I'm going to spend quite a bit of time answering questions from listeners. So pull up a seat and make yourself comfortable. Here we go. First off, to start off with some announcements, I would like to say thank you to everybody who has left me a message on Ravelry or emailed me. I know there's a lot of new listeners after I did that interview with Susan of Knit a Journey, and then I also heard the Knitmore Girls mention me on their podcast, and after that, I got a pretty big kick up in the numbers, so thank you to all of you ladies. And if you're coming to me through one of those podcasts, welcome. I also wanted to mention about the last episode, episode 7, with my brother Austin, where we talked about soil. There is a link that I put up on the show notes that has to do with soil texture that I think would be helpful. I didn't mention it at all on that episode, but it's a link to help you determine approximately what your soil texture is just by feeling your soil, and it goes into good detail in describing how to do that. So if you're curious and you don't want to have to send your soil in to be tested at a lab to figure out what the contents of your soil are, you can at least get a good idea of what your soil texture is by following the instructions on this link. It's really simple. You don't need any fancy tools or anything, just your hands. So if you're interested in that, make sure you check out that link on my Blogspot page, which is thecrookedrow.blogspot.com. And again, thank you to my brother Austin, who joined me for the podcast last time on soil. We will be doing more of that, and we haven't recorded any more for that yet, but we will be spreading that out over some time over this several months this fall. If there's anything specifically that you would like answered about soil, feel free to contact me on Ravelry. I'm Crooked Row on Ravelry, or also emailing me at crookedrow@gmail.com. Any questions you might have for my brother, I can pass along to him. Also, there is an announcement on how you are directly listening to the podcast. Currently, the podcast is hosted through Podomatic, and I originally signed up with Podomatic because you can sign up for a free account with them, which I thought would be a good idea since I wasn't real sure how the podcasting thing was going to go. I didn't want to have to commit to any kind of a monthly payment if I wasn't going to like it. So I initially signed up with them. But now that I'm doing this a little bit more and decided that I'm definitely going to keep doing it, I think it's going to make sense for me to switch the podcast over to being hosted by Libsyn, which if you listen to other knitting podcasts, you know it's a pretty common podcast hosting site. And I want to make sure that that transition happens smoothly without losing any listeners. I'm going to try and overlap them if at all possible, and I will make the appropriate changes in iTunes. It might involve having to resubscribe through iTunes or whatever software you use. I will make sure to post any information on that in the Ravelry site. I'm not for sure that that's going to happen this week, but it will be happening in upcoming weeks. And when it does, I will let you know. But I just wanted to give you a big heads up on that so that I didn't just all of a sudden disappear from your iPod and you wondered what happened. So yeah, that's it. I'll be switching from Podomatic to Libsyn sometime in the near future. I'll let you know when it happens. If there's any confusion, check the Crooked Row podcast group on Ravelry or the Blogspot page, and I will have information on there. So now moving into a knitting update. Gosh, it's been a while since I've talked about the projects I'm working on, and I've gotten a lot done since I've talked to you last. I'm trying to remember where I even was. I know I was swatching for the Lapis Yoke cardigan by Hannah Fettig, which is in the fall knit scene, and I had mentioned that I was getting gauge with the yarn that I had, which is the Plymouth Merino Superwash. And the gauge required is, I believe, 16 stitches per inch. And the yarn really wants to be more of a 20 stitches per inch yarn. It makes a much better fabric that way. So I'm pretty sure I'm not going to be able to make that sweater out of that yarn. I'd still like to make it, but I don't have anything on hand right now to make it out of. And I'm really wanting to use the yarn for something else. I don't want to let it just sit in my stash forever. So if anybody has made a really great sweater that they love that is a 20 stitches per inch gauge, let me know. I'm looking right now. I know there's several out there. I thought about maybe the Acer cardigan. I've even thought about making another Seneca because I love the first Seneca that I made. And I thought about doing that, but then I thought, well, that might be a shame. There's so many good sweater patterns out there. I'd like to make a few more of the really good ones before I go back and start repeating myself. But that's always an idea if I can't find anything else that I'm for sure in love with. In the meantime, though, I have found another sweater pattern that is looking very tasty to me. So I am going to be casting on before too long for the Gwendolyn sweater, which is out of the Fall Twist Collective, Fall 2010, and it's by Fiona Ellis, and it's a really heavily cabled pullover in a worsted weight yarn. I think it actually comes for instructions for either a pullover or a cardigan, and it has a hood, and I'm a sucker for hoods, and I love cables, and I really haven't done much with cables lately. I guess the Seneca sweater that I made does have cables, but they're smaller. It's not that dominant all over cable-y kind of sweater, which is kind of what I'd like to make. So I've purchased that pattern, and I am going to be making it out of the new Barocco yarn called Remix, which is made out of all recycled materials. It's a collection of different materials. There's no wool in it. It is some synthetic and some natural. There's some silk and rayon, I believe, and then there's also cotton and nylon. I haven't actually received it yet. I ordered it from Webs last week, and I have not received it yet. So hopefully I can get the gauge and everything to match up on that, because the gauge for that sweater is 20 stitches per inch. And if you're wondering why I didn't just use the yarn I have to make the Gwendolyn, the first answer is I don't have enough yarn. And yeah, I could probably go back to the yarn store and see if they have more skeins of that dye lot and do that. And that would work. And I considered doing that. But the reason I ultimately decided not to do that is that the Plymouth Merino Superwash that I have is a really dark charcoal gray. I mean, it's almost black. It's very, very dark. And I don't want to go through all that work of doing all of those cables to have it not show up very well in a dark yarn. I'd like to make it out of something lighter to where the cables are really going to pop and they're going to be really noticeable and not just kind of fade into the background with the dark color. So I'd like to save that darker yarn for a more simple sweater. So the color in the Remix that I ordered is called Patina, which is a very, very similar color, kind of a brown gray, that is what the sweater in Twist Collective is made out of. I'm going to opt not to do the little the stripes of a contrasting color. I like it. I don't dislike it necessarily, but I just feel like it would maybe be a little more timeless if I left that out. I have a feeling that that might be a feature that would become dated, maybe. So I'm just going to do it all in the solid color. And like I said, I'm waiting for the yarn to come so I can cast that on. Last time I had mention that I just started working on the Willoughby Rap by Jared Flood out of the Made in Brooklyn booklet. And I just barely started it, and I have now finished it. I made that out of the Queensland Rustic Tweed, which is a wool alpaca blend. And I think it even has, cashmere. Nope, just wool and alpaca. But it's a really nice yarn. I made it in a color that's kind of a gray-green. Not a mint green. I don't like mint green, but it's kind of a grayish pale green. I really enjoyed the pattern. It wasn't ever one that I completely memorized, but I memorized part of it. So I got to where I could just glance at the chart and I didn't have to stare at it for every stitch, which was nice. It kept moving faster and faster that way. I got that done and have been fortunate enough to have a few cool days that have been cool enough to want to wear it. And then in the meantime, while I have been waiting for my yarn to arrive to cast on another sweater, because I usually like to have a sweater plus some other project that I'm working on. And I haven't had a sweater since I finished the Sarissa several weeks ago. So in the meantime, I've been making some socks. I am making just a pair of Hermione's Everyday Socks out of Zauberball Crazy, which is a 2-ply yarn, but it has the color gradients that Zauberball has. And the colorway I have, I'm not sure what the number is, but it's very fall appropriate. It looks like a pheasant to me. I've named my socks the Pheasant Socks because it goes from golds to oranges to browns, and then there's a little bit of green and even just a little bit of teal blue in there. And it looks just like the colors in Pheasant Feathers. So I altered the pattern a little bit. I'm not doing it on 64 stitches, which is, I believe, what the original pattern is. I've added stitches. I'm doing it on 72 stitches on size 0 needles, so it's making a tighter gauge. I think I'm getting about 10 stitches per inch because I like my socks bulletproof. And so I'm doing that, and I am almost to the toe on the second sock, so I've about got those knocked out. It's a really simple pattern. It's free on Ravelry. And it's just a good basic sock, almost like a stockinette sock, except more interesting, but it doesn't really take any more brain power. The heel that it uses is the Eye of Partridge heel, which I have never done before. I guess I didn't realize what the Eye of Partridge heel was. I had thought before when I was doing slip stitch heels, why don't you just slip every other stitch, and then on the next row you would slip the other stitches that you had knit before, which is what the Eye of Partridge heel is. So you end up with a really, really dense, thick fabric, but you don't have those lines like a slip stitch heel does. I mean, to look at it, it looks like stockinette, but really it is twice as thick as stockinette. The downside, of course, is that it takes twice as long to knit that then, of course. So I guess that would be the downside, but I like the way it looks. I'm not real sure what the purpose of having the garter stitches on the outside is, which is how this is written, as you have on the heel flap, you have 3 stitches that are in garter stitch, and then the majority of the stitches in the middle are all knit with the slip stitch pattern. I'm not sure if that's meant to make it easier to pick up stitches or what, but so there's that. I like that. I think I'm going to start using that in place of slip stitch heels now. Just because I like the way it looks better, and I don't mind having to spend a little bit more time working on the heel. And as far as working with the Zauberball yarn, this is the first time I'd ever worked with it. I had heard that some people disliked it, that it was really splitty, being a 2-ply. And I think I mentioned before, I don't usually have a problem with yarns being splitty. I'm not sure if it's how I knit, or at the tension that I'm using, or the needles I use, or what, but I've never really understood yarn being splitty. Maybe it's because I knit with so much crap before I actually started knitting with good yarn that I just don't notice it. But it doesn't bother me. Since it is a 2-ply, that's part of the reason why I'm knitting it very tightly, is to make it a more durable fabric. so I don't just walk right through them. But I like it. The color changes are slow, but it's just enough to keep you interested when you're working on a simple pattern so that it doesn't get boring. And then the last project I'd like to talk about this week is another Cookie A sock. It is Angie, and this is another one out of the Sock Innovation book. I'm making this out of the Cascade Heritage sock yarn in a gray color. And the pattern looks to me, it looks like a three-strand braid, but not like a tight cable braid that really pops out. It's kind of like a slower crossing, looser braid, if that makes sense. You don't actually do any cabling. It's just done with yarn overs and knit two togethers. And the pattern is actually going really fast because every other row, you're pretty much just knitting or purling as the stitches already lie. You're really only working yarn overs and decreases every other row. And it's gone really quick. After doing a pair of socks that's 10 stitches per inch, doing a pair of socks that's 8 stitches per inch, they really seem to fly. So I'm doing those on size 1s. The pattern calls for 1.5s, but I found that to be just a little loose. I'm doing it on 1s. And I am already down to the foot on the first sock. I was homesick yesterday, and I laid in bed for a lot of the day and just didn't even get out of bed. I just would sit up and feel dizzy, and so I'd lay back down. But then in the afternoon, I was able to get up and sit on the couch and knit, and so that's what I did all afternoon, and I got most of a sock done. Unfortunately, I let my children watch far too much television, but, you know, hey, at least I was up. That's as good as I could do yesterday, and I have a sock to show for it, so I'm enjoying that. I am also going to be using that sock, since it is a Cookie A sock, to enter myself in the little competition that Erin from the Anatomy of Knitting podcast is doing. She is going to be taking a trip to Germany this winter and will be visiting the Wollmeise shop. And she's having a little contest, and to qualify for it, you have to knit either a Cookie A sock or, I think it's Wendy Johnson. Wendy Johnson pattern. So a slightly more challenging pattern, not just a basic stockinette sock, because it's full Wollmeise. You need to work for it. So the deal is that you enter the contest by knitting a sock by one of these two designers, and I think then she's just choosing someone randomly from that, and then she will buy you a skein of Wollmeise in a colorway of your choice, or as close to it as she can get when she goes to Germany. So I thought about not mentioning that part on the podcast because I don't want any competition. I want to be able to get a skein of Wollmeise. But I would encourage you to do it. And if you're not already listening to the Anatomy of Knitting, I will put a link to that in the show notes so you can find Erin and all of her woolly goodness that she has. And maybe even knit yourself a pair of socks and get qualified to win a skein of Wollmeise. I think the deadline is clear till the end of November, I believe. I could be wrong on that, but she's giving people plenty of time. It's not like you have to get it knocked out in a week or something. So that's what I've been knitting on, and a little bit about what I will be knitting on in the very near future. And so now I'll move on to the next segment. Dirt under my nails. Probably the biggest project that I've had so far in the last few weeks has been cleaning up tree branches. We had a storm a couple weeks ago now, 2 weeks ago, that came through on a Monday night, and it was just a thunderstorm. We were in a tornado warning, but I'm not sure where in the county that tornado was. I don't think that's what hit us. It was just straight line winds. But when you have straight line winds of 80 to 90 miles an hour, they can do some damage. And we have some large mature ash trees in our yard. And if you're familiar with ash trees, you'll know that they are a relatively softer wooded tree, which means that they are a little bit easier to break up in a windstorm. And that's what happened to ours. We have one really, really big one in our front yard that had to have been planted before 1940. It's a big tree. And we had several large branches with a diameter of anywhere from 6 to 10 inches come down in our front yard. Thankfully, they did not hit our house. They were really close to hitting our house. There were twigs and leaves that were brushing up against the siding, but the larger branches landed farther out. They did, however, smash part of the chain link fence that we just put up this summer. So we have some repair work to do on that. But the good news is it didn't hit our house, didn't damage the roof, and it didn't even land on any other plants besides the grass. So really the only damage was to the tree itself and then to the chain link fence. And luckily it wasn't enough damage that it warranted taking the whole tree down. I am a little worried that some of the limbs where they separated from the tree are going to leave wounds too large for the tree to heal over properly. In fact, I'm sure that that's going to be the case. There's some big, big exposed areas. And so I'm a little afraid of some rot setting in to the trunk of the tree, which isn't really that abnormal, but it does make it, you know, it depends on who you talk to. Some people argue that that's not necessarily a bad thing, but yeah, you know, I just am afraid that this is going to be one more chink in its armor and lead to the decline of the tree, which will mean that eventually it'll have to be taken down, which is really sad. It's a really big old tree, and the mature trees was a big part of why we decided to buy this house, so it would be very sad to see it go. But it looks like we'll be getting a few more years out of it anyway, hopefully more than that. So yeah, we had tree limbs down from our house that stretched clear out to the street. You couldn't walk down our front step, but just less than an hour after the storm rolled through and the rain stopped, we had a neighbor come by with a bobcat who helped lift some of the branches off, the ones that were closer to the street, and carry those away for us. And in the following days, there was a tree service that the town brought in to clean up everybody's downed limbs and trim the trees up and get rid of all the dangerous limbs that might still fall. And it just made me so thankful that I live in a small town where when something like this happens, all of the townspeople come together and help each other clean up. And we had so many people come and offer their help, and people that did help, like I said, they did work with a bobcat that would have taken us all day to do in just a matter of like 10 minutes. So I'm just really thankful for the neighbors that I have and all the work that they put into it. The volunteer firemen in town spent most of the week helping everybody get their messes cleaned up. There were people that had windows blown in and just a lot of tree damage. Luckily, at our house, we only had the power out for about 12 hours or so. There are places in town where they had power out for a few days, so I was lucky that it wasn't any longer than that. So next to that, other yard work seemed kind of minor. I've been talking mostly about the vegetable garden, and I just realized I've really failed to acknowledge a lot of the stuff that's been going on in the ornamental beds. And a lot of that is because I get a lot of that stuff established in the spring, and then I sit back and enjoy it, but it's not necessarily what I'm working on, so it's not always at the forefront of my mind. So I'm going to talk a little bit about the vegetable garden, and then I'm going to talk a little bit more about the ornamental garden as well. One thing in the vegetable slash fruit garden are the raspberries, which I'm continuing to get a good harvest out of. But I have noticed a new pest. I am getting little white wormy maggots in my raspberries. And now I have heard, as many of you probably have if you live on the west coast of the United States, I have heard of the spotted winged Drosophila. And that is a a fruit fly. Drosophila is a group of, there's many species of fruit flies. There's a lot of different kinds. But the new one that is becoming a really huge pest on the West Coast particularly is the spotted wing Drosophila. And it can obviously be identified by the males having spotted wings. Now, the females do not have spots on their wings. And you can't really tell what they are unless you look at them under a microscope. But what makes them so much more damaging than ordinary fruit flies is that the females have some distinguishing characteristics on their girly parts. Female insects have what's called an ovipositor, which is what allows them to lay eggs. It's their egg-laying mechanism, so to speak. And with this species of fruit fly, the females have a very jagged ovipositor, which looks like a weapon, honestly. But what it does is it allows them to not just lay their eggs where there is an open wound in the fruit, an existing wound, which is how normal fruit flies function. They have to have an opening in the skin to be able to lay their eggs. But these girls can lay their eggs in any soft-skinned fruit. They can essentially just cut a little hole in the skin and deposit their eggs. Which means that soft-fruited fruits, like berries particularly, are really subject to having these flies lay their eggs and spoiling the fruit without having any other problems. And they can be really tricky to get rid of. Now, I was a little surprised to see this, and that might not be what I have. I have not heard of it reaching this far into the United States. I could be wrong, though. I've just heard of it on the West Coast, but that might be because there's more of a berry-producing industry on the West Coast, and here in the middle of the U.S., it's pretty much just, you know, homeowners growing raspberries. It's less commercial growing of raspberries. So I'm not 100% sure that that's what I have. I have not done any traps yet to specifically identify what I have, but from what I have seen from the pictures of the little maggots, it's what it looks like. So I decided, it's one of those things where, you know, when you go to the doctor and they say, well, we're not sure you have influenza, but if it's not influenza, it's something really, really similar, and we would treat it the same way anyways. This is similar to that. If it's not the spotted wing Drosophila, it's something similar, and I'm going to treat it the same way. What I did was, I have been making sure I don't let any of the spoiled fruit drop to the ground. The berries that have the maggots in them, you usually know without looking. If you go to pluck the raspberry off of the stem, it feels just kind of soft and squishy. Usually towards the tip is where I've noticed it, towards the bottom part of the berry. It just feels soft and squishy. And if you break that open, you'll usually see the little squirmy maggots, one or more per fruit, and of varying sizes depending on their development. What's recommended is that you do not leave those on the plant, don't leave them around the plants, but instead bag them up and throw them in the trash, or you can dig a hole and bury them. It also says that if the maggots are small, they might not be really noticeable, and eating them is not going to really, it's not going to pose a health problem. Yeah, that's what I thought too. Gross, right? So I'm not going to be eating my maggoty raspberries. So instead what I did was I pulled them off and I buried them, because there is something that is more satisfying about burying them alive than throwing them in the trash can. So that's what I did. When I was separating out the bad ones from the good ones, it's not like it was every single berry. I still have a lot of good fruits. So yeah, a little disappointed. I'm hoping it's not going to be a huge pest in the future. And I'm finding that if I make sure I get out there and pick the berries right away as soon as they ripen, I have a lot less of a problem. It's when I wait for 5 or more days in between harvestings that I have a problem. So that's raspberries. And in other disappointing news, my PJM rhododendron has died. And I'm going to credit this one to a wet spring and summer. It looks like the roots just completely rotted off. It went down really rapidly, looked fine all year, and then all of a sudden the leaves started to curl and look kind of bad. It's actually symptoms that are remarkably similar to drying out, which plants that are overwatered and plants that are drying out tend to have the same symptoms, because if they're overwatered, it kills the roots, and if it kills the roots, they're not able to take up much water. So it essentially creates the same symptoms as being too dry, which can make it really hard for people trying to figure out how much water their plants need. Well, I have not had to water this plant all summer because we've just had a lot more rain than we have in previous years. So when I noticed that the shrub was completely turning brown and dying, I went to go pull it out and I just tugged on the stem and it just came out with this really small ball of roots around it, like the size of an orange maybe, and everything else had been rotted off. So yeah, they rotted, and rhododendrons can be susceptible to, well, they can be susceptible to a lot of things. I mean, let's face it, they really just don't want to grow in Nebraska. You know, if it doesn't survive, I'm not going to try and plant another one. I believe in survival of the fittest in my garden, and only the tough will make it. So I'm going to be replacing it with a beauty berry. Now, I bought this beauty berry this spring and kept it on the container on the porch because the soil was just so wet with all the rain that we had. I didn't get it planted out right away, and I kept waiting for the right soil conditions that happened to coincide with the time I had to do it, and it just never happened. And we got some really, really hot days in the middle of summer, and I forgot to water it, and the whole thing turned brown, and I just thought it was dead. But luckily, because I was lazy about actually getting it thrown in the compost pile, this fall, now that it's cooled down and we've had some more rain and the pot has been staying wet, it's resprouted. So, yay, bonus, right? So I've decided that since this little beauty berry, despite my best efforts to kill it, even though it has survived, I thought, well, hey, it's a trooper. Maybe it will do well where the other shrub has died. So, serendipity. I will be planting the beauty berry where the PJM rhododendron was. And next to it, I will be planting a clematis. Much like I talked about in one of the early podcasts about companion plants, I like growing clematis in amongst other shrubs and using the shrub as a trellis. And then the clematis, which is a vine, grows up through the shrub and you get blooming that looks like the shrub is blooming, but really it's the clematis vine. And then beauty berry, if you're not familiar with that, the big attraction to that shrub is that it gets these metallic little purple berries towards fall that are really attractive, and it does well in shade. So it seems like there's a much smaller list of shrubs that do well in shade as opposed to those in sun. So it's nice to have something sparkly for the shade. That is what I will be doing. And I'm looking forward to fall color in my garden. And September is just such a wonderful transition month. You get the fullness of harvest, and all of the annuals have grown out to their fullest extent. The containers look great, at least in the years when I remember to water them, and everything just looks full and beautiful and lush. And before you get those first hard freezes, while everything is still blooming to some extent, and you start to get the early fall color, that's just, I think, the best time of year. You still have some flowers and some fall color in combination in the garden, and I think it's just the richest display of color those couple of weeks before the first hard frost. So I am thoroughly enjoying that. We went apple picking this past weekend, our family, and then we went with my brother and my parents. And it was a beautiful, crisp fall day, and the apples were delicious. We have a super secret hiding spot for some trees where we like to go pick some heirloom apples. They are a variety called Ortley, or they're also known as Woolman's Long Pippin, and they are a very old variety that has an incredible flavor. They're a small apple, but the flavor is so much better than the usual varieties you grow in the store. And the pick your own place that we went to, not the place with the heirloom apples, but a lot of times they'll have varieties like Golden Delicious and Red Delicious and Jonathan's. That's what we came across. And I just think, you know, there's so many more interesting varieties. Why would you grow some of these most common varieties? If I'm going to go pick my own apples, I want something different than what I can just buy at the grocery store. I want something unusual, something unique, something that's harder to come across. And, we have a super secret hiding spot, and we're able to get some delicious apples, and we're really enjoying those. I haven't done a lot of looking into it so far, but I'm thinking about even trying to track down one of these trees to grow in our yard. Again, it's either known as Ortley or Woolman's Long Pippin, and I would highly recommend it for anyone wanting to plant an apple tree. I can't say for certain where they're available. I don't know for sure, but I'm planning on looking it up, and if nothing else, I might just get crazy and try and do some grafting of my own next spring. I asked my husband what he thought about adding an apple tree to our yard, and his response was it sounded easier than a pet or a baby, so he was okay with it. So hopefully I'll be planting an apple tree next year. So moving on to gardening questions. First of all, thank you for everybody who has sent a question. I know I've let some of them just kind of sit there for a long time. Some of you I have gotten back to via email or Ravelry messaging, especially if it was something where you're needing help with something ASAP, I would try and shoot back a message as I had time to do so. But there are some that have just been kind of collecting, and I thought I would take today as an opportunity to just go through some of those and answer a whole bunch of them. The first one was about canning. I can't remember who it was. I'm sorry. I didn't go through and write down everybody's names, but it was about canning tomatoes using the method where you heat the jars up and sterilize them and then keep them in a hot oven and then fill them full of your hot tomato product, whether it be whole tomatoes or sauce or whatever. And then instead of boiling them in a hot water bath, you just put the lid on, and then as the jar cools, the air will shrink and it will cause the seal to pop shut, and voila, you don't have to use a water bath. And I am familiar with this, and I might be wrong, but I think that a lot of canning used to be done this way. But I also know that the FDA does not recommend this method just because it's a little less certain to create a really tight seal and you can have a higher risk of foodborne contaminants. And it is faster. And it's not that you can't ever get a good seal, but you're going to get a tighter seal and a better seal if you use the water bath method or with a pressure cooker. I wouldn't recommend it. I would rather use the water bath just to make sure for myself. I figure you go through all the work of growing the produce and then making the sauce or whatever other preparation you've done to the food. It's probably worth an extra 20 minutes in the water bath just to make sure it's going to be safe and last a long time for you. Okay, next question had to do with what you do with your plants in the fall as far as what needs to be cut back and things like that. And people do this differently. There are a lot of people who really like to get stuff cleaned up just as soon as it gets frosted back and like to clear everything out and have a nice smooth ground so that things are ready to go in the spring. But I don't do that. I don't really cut anything back in my ornamental garden until late winter or early spring. And this is why. Around here, there just isn't a lot for winter interest. And if you cut back all of your grasses and perennials, I mean, they might be kind of ragged looking, brown, gray, whatever, dead looking. But they're at least forms in the garden. They're at least shapes or an outline. If you cut it all back and your ground is completely bare and exposed, that looks worse. I would prefer to see things left there, almost like a dried flower arrangement, and then cut it back in the spring just as the new growth is emerging. Now, there's some exceptions to this. If you have a plant that has been suffering some kind of disease issue on the foliage or flowers or fruit or whatever, you'll want to remove that in the fall so that you don't have the disease pathogens lying around in the soil just waiting to cause problems in the spring. And peonies would be a good example of this. They are susceptible to botrytis. And if you have that issue with your peonies, you want to make sure that they get cut back and the diseased material thrown away so that it won't reinfect the new foliage in the spring. And so for that reason, you would want to cut back things like that. But plants that don't have that issue, I leave up in the garden, especially grasses. They are really beautiful and they can remain ornamental all winter. The other part of that question had to do with mulching, as far as when was a good time to mulch. It kind of depends on who you ask. I like mulching in the early spring when stuff is just starting to come up and you can see where it is, but not before it gets all big and bushy and grown out to its full size, because it's easier to spread mulch around just little tiny tufts of green. So usually when I mulch is in that early spring time, after I've cut back the dead growth from the previous year and before the plants get big. That's when I mulch. Now, sometimes, especially if you live in a climate where your soil is slow to warm up in the summer, a lot of times in those cases, it's recommended to wait to mulch until after the soil has had a chance to warm up. Because if you're throwing mulch on in early spring, it's going to insulate the cold ground and make it a little bit slower to warm up. Around here, I'm really not that worried about that. I'm more interested in getting the mulch on before the plants get too big. But if you live somewhere where that's an issue, you might want to wait until it heats up and then put the mulch on. And then that mulch is going to help with the moisture and keeping the roots cooler during the heat of the summer. There's nothing wrong with putting mulch on things in the fall. It's just a little bit trickier if you're leaving growth up over winter. It can be a little bit trickier. The other thing is, if you're cutting plants back in the fall and then throwing mulch on top of them, you really want to be careful not to cover over the crowns too much. If you're using some kind of mulch to insulate it to keep something alive in the winter, like it really is barely cold hardy in your zone, you might have to do that, but you can also end up with the crowns of plants rotting out from staying too wet underneath that layer of mulch. So the best thing I can think of to do for those types of plants is to just leave the foliage growing up on top of it. That actually acts to insulate the crown from temperature extremes during the winter without having to put a layer of mulch on it that's going to keep it too wet. So in summary, cut back perennials late winter, early spring, mulch very shortly after that, and you should be good to go. There was another question about plants that you could plant that would fertilize naturally. It's from a listener who doesn't want to use any synthetic chemicals on their lawn, but had heard about plants that you could plant that would contribute to the fertility of the soil. And what you are likely talking about are legumes, which are plants in the bean family, any plant in the bean family, which there are very, very many. But quite often, plants in the bean family will be used as a cover crop. What they can do, and it's not the plants themselves, it's the plant that has a symbiotic relationship with a bacteria in their roots called rhizobium. Now, plants themselves are not able to extract nitrogen from the atmosphere. They have to get it in the form of nitrates in the soil. But legumes have this relationship with this bacteria that lives inside of their roots. And that bacteria can fix nitrogen. So what happens is that bacteria fixes nitrogen from the air, just as straight N2 nitrogen, which, by the way, nitrogen is the largest component in the air that we breathe, but it's an extremely inert and non-reactive gas until it's converted into another form. So these rhizobium can fix the nitrogen and turn it into a usable compound for the plant, and then they in turn get benefits back from the plant, as in a place to live and some other things that I've forgotten about. But what you need to know is that when you plant beans or peas or a legume cover crop like a vetch or fava beans or something like that, that's what's happening is the rhizobium bacteria in conjunction with the plant is fixing the nitrogen, and then if you take that cover crop and turn it into the soil, you are essentially adding nitrogen to the system in that way. In the farmland around where I live, you'll very often see a corn crop planted one year, and then the next year they'll plant soybeans, and then they'll alternate back and forth. And that's a big reason why, is because the soybeans help replenish the nitrogen to the soil, whereas the corn plants just take it out. So there's that. Now, another thing as far as fertility, besides just planting bean crops rotated through on your garden, the other best thing you can do is to incorporate a little bit of compost to your soil every year. It doesn't have to be a lot. It doesn't have to be a big foot thick of compost, and you don't have to dig it in every year either. But if you just take a thin layer, like an inch or two, of compost and spread that out over the top of your soil, maybe lightly work it into the top few inches of your soil, that will go a long way in improving your soil nutrients. Now you want to be careful a little bit, because if you add too much compost that isn't fully broken down, like a lot of dry leaves, what you'll end up with is that organic matter actually will take nutrients from the soil. Okay, it's kind of a complex situation, but essentially, in order to finish breaking down, the microbes that are going to break down the compost, if it's not fully broken down already, are going to rob nitrogen and other nutrients from the soil until they're finished breaking down, at which point then it will be released to the soil. But if you add too much all at once and it's not fully broken down, then you could actually be depleting nutrients from your soil, if that makes sense. Now, if you're buying bagged compost, then that's probably going to be broken down far enough that you don't have to deal with it. Where you run into issues with that is usually if you are using compost from a home composting bin and you have a lot of dried leaves or other materials high in carbon that have not been fully broken down. And if you're adding that to your soil, that's what's going to tend to rob the nitrogen from the soil. So just know that if you're adding compost, adding a little bit at a time over time is the best way to go. Okay, I know we're running a little long, but I want to catch up with all these questions. I've got one more question about little worms that are eating Brussels sprouts and then move to the broccoli. And this listener said they were black and with white and yellow stripes, or maybe it was a combination of black, white, and yellow stripiness. And somebody had recommended to her to use 7, that it was a cabbage worm, and to spray it with 7. And she didn't have any luck with that and wanted to know what to do. Well, whoever identified it as cabbage worm could have very well have been correct. There's a striped cabbage worm that matches that description. But 7 will not work on those cabbage worms. 7 is a broad spectrum insecticide that can kill a lot of things, but it kills adult insects. It's not going to kill caterpillars of any kind. What you need to kill back caterpillars if they're eating at your crops is BT. And BT stands for Bacillus thuringiensis. So you can see why it's usually shortened to BT. And what that is actually a bacteria. You can find this in garden centers. It's used in organic practices as long as it's something, an additive that's added on top of a plant. Now you might have heard of BT crops, and that's with genetic engineering, and that's a whole different thing. But just using the bacteria and spreading that on the plant, what happens is the caterpillars will eat that bacteria while it's on the leaf, and then when it gets in their gut, it creates an infection that kills them. And this is an extremely effective way to kill back caterpillars that are the larva of either a moth or a butterfly. And that's what this is. The adult version of the cabbage worm is a little white butterfly. And it is a pest on cold crops such as the broccoli, cauliflower, Brussels sprouts, any of those things. There's also a cabbage worm that's just a solid green color too. Now, one thing that can be even easier than doing all of that is if the plants are small, even if they're bigger, usually these worms are pretty obvious, and it's one pest where it's pretty easy to just go out and pick them off and squish them and get them off of there. One little caterpillar can cause a lot of damage, and it's usually not a case of having hundreds and hundreds of them. It's usually a case of having, you know, tens or 50, depending on how many plants you have. But instead of running to the garden store and getting something to put on it, most often either you or the nearest 10-year-old boy that you know can go out and just squish those little bad boys, and then they're not a problem. Now, the adults, if you're seeing a lot of those little white, they're small white butterflies with a little black spot on the leaf. If you're seeing a lot of those flying around your plants, then what you're seeing is the adults continuing to lay eggs on the plant, and you're going to continue having the issue. So the best method is just to keep an eye on them. If you're seeing damage, look for the worms and squish them. And if it's something where you feel like you need to treat them, treating them with Bacillus thuringiensis or BT is going to be the way to go. Phew, okay, that was a lot of questions, and we are running really close to being another hour-long episode. So that is going to wrap it up for this week. I'm starting to lose my voice a little bit. I've got a cold, and I hope my voice has not been an issue. So I can't say for sure when the next episode will be. I know I'm kind of being erratic with episodes lately, with having nothing for several weeks and then two of them back to back. But, you know, life happens, and I'm doing this as I'm able and as I have time to do it. So I hope you understand. And if you have a garden question that you'd like to ask, I gave my contact information earlier, but I'm more than happy to get those. I might not be able to answer all of them in a podcast, but if I don't, I'll try and give you some feedback via email or Ravelry messages. So keep them coming. And again, I am Crooked Row on Ravelry, and you can also find the Crooked Row podcast group on Ravelry. And you can email me at crookedrow@gmail.com and find show notes posted at thecrookedrow.blogspot.com. Thanks for listening. I hope you have a great fall, and I hope you are not running into too many problems in your garden. If you are, I hope you are learning more about the biology on your property. There's always something to learn, even when there's disaster. So keep that in mind as you garden, and I will talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
I've done it again. Made spectacular claims and lied in the name of good love. And I think I recall someone brought me here. Memory is not clear, just what it was. Good love, good love. You define yourself by your company, by the promises you made. and the ones that you keep. Sleep the sleep of the blessed. Dream the dreams of the whole. Forget when you wake how far you've fallen down below. Could blow me a kiss if you think it brings luck. It's the faith that makes it work. So what the hell, why not sleep the sleep of the blessed? Dream the dreams of the whole. Forget when you wake how far we've fallen down below, down below, down from a good love that we had, a good, good.